Crosstalk with your hosts, Dan Matthews and Max Frater.
Full bore now, Max. We're basically 2 weeks, give or take, into the bulk of the season. The second weekend of collegiate lacrosse winding down. Syracuse holding a big lead over Cornell as we speak, 14-5 at my last count. The Edmonton Rush playing host to the Colorado Mammoth, and they are up 11-4 with about 10 minutes to go in the fourth quarter. And later on this evening, we will speak with Derek Keenan, head coach of those Edmonton Rush, about the turnaround their team has had since he returned to the bench.
Big-time sweep if they're able to maintain this lead that they have over the Mammoth, and that's going to make things look a lot different in the West Division. Edmonton came off to kind of a rocky start, while on the other hand, the Mammoth went 3-0 and have since dropped last week, and then now to Edmonton on Friday, and then on the road as well. So you see again this back-to-back play here in the NLL after having an off week last week. Might have affected the Mammoth pretty hard with the travel schedule, but losing at home to Edmonton, that one's going to hurt them the most, I think.
Yeah, that home loss to Edmonton will take a while to shake off, and then going on the road and essentially getting hammered is not good. The Duke University Blue Devils rebounded with a 16-6 win today after going down to the hometown boys here in Denver, the Denver Pioneers, 17-13 yesterday. And that was an interesting game and kind of the way it shook out, because it was very reminiscent of what we saw out of Denver a couple of years ago. And that was that it took them a little while to get themselves started. But once they did, things really started to click, and they had a big third period, went on a huge run in the second half after trailing 8-5, and outscored Duke 12-5 in the second half for that 17-13 win. And the Pioneers will again obviously be ranked at the top of the polls, with Notre Dame sitting right behind them. Duke, Hopkins, what's going to happen to them? We'll get to talk with Quint Kesnick a little bit about that in our first segment. But Max, overall as a whole, we're off to a great start in this lacrosse season.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm having a hard time just peeking away from this Cuse-Cornell game going on over here, even though it's a 14-5 game. When I turned it on before I came over here to start the show with you, I just watched the first quarter. Only one goal scored, but I mean, it had everything you needed in a great lacrosse game. It was just very back and forth, quick restarts, a lot of shots coming from both sides, great saves, big hits, and then Syracuse really turned it on. Of the games that I've been able to watch either on ESPN or on broadcasts online, Syracuse is my favorite offense right now. Granted, I didn't get the chance to watch the DU-Duke game yesterday. When you see those guys, I mean, the way that Denver is stacked is just incredible. So I'm looking forward to watching them. But as of right now, with Rice and Stats and Donahue and Hakeem Leckie, I mean, that guy has got some shakes. He's been putting on a clinic against Cornell today. Syracuse's offense it's been a blast to watch today.
Yeah, we'll get to see the Pioneers live and in person next week, as we will be doing our first live play-by-play on the Waxworm Radio Experience right here in Denver. We'll have Canisius and Furman on Saturday afternoon at 1 p.m. Eastern time, and we'll follow that with Canisius Air Force on Sunday. So we'll have our first live lacrosse here on the Waxworm Radio Experience. Big show lined up for you today. We'll talk some women's lacrosse, some MCLA lacrosse. We'll have interviews with the head coach at Detroit Mercy, Chris Colon, and the head coach of the Edmonton Rush, Derek Keenan. And we'll get it all started when we come back with Quint Kesnick, our ESPN analyst. You're listening to Lacrosse Talk on the Waxworm Radio Experience.
Okay, so 5 tacos of cheese and a large soda, that's $10,012. Please drive around.
Wait, 10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's $12, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
So, you know, I'm a dog, and I'm kind of new to this family, but I've noticed a trend. My humans do this thing where they go around and get all my toys and hide them in this basket, but it's always the same basket. And it's always the same place. And then they act so surprised when I find them. But I'm like, hello, that's where you put it last time. Humans are the worst at hide-and-go-seek.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
We're back on Lacrosse Talk. Dan Matthews and Max Frater on the Wax Worm Radio Experience. And we're pleased to bring in our first guest of the evening, Quint Kesnick from ESPN. And Quint, thanks so much for joining us tonight. We sure appreciate it.
Hi, gentlemen. Interesting and fun weekend, and always good to be along for the ride with you guys.
We sure appreciate it. Hey, Quint, the first thing I want to talk about is, what do we make of Towson's victory over Hopkins midweek?
Well, I think it showed two things. I think, you know, obviously we know that the teams ranked, you know, 10 to 30 are dangerous. While it was Towson's opener, they had a lot of time to prepare for Hopkins, and for Hopkins, they were coming off a Saturday game. Towson made the plays. They were the deserving team that night. You know, you look at them, they only played 20 guys in that game. I worry about them long-term in terms of their depth. But they're a good team, and they'll be one of the favorites in the CAA. And I thought it showed some shortcomings of a Hopkins team who is going to be good. I'm just not sure if they're going to be great.
Quint, it's a pleasure to have you back on Lacrosse Talk with us. I want to start with the big matchup of the week in Division I, and that was between the top team, Denver, and number 3, Duke. Talk a little bit about what you saw with the Pioneers opener. As Dan mentioned before the break, they started things off a little slow before exploding offensively in the second half. And Duke, I mean, I know the Blue Devils have their struggles in February, early March, but I feel like this team is different than the past two championship teams who did the same. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I thought the face-off disparity, especially in the second half, was the difference in the ball game. Denver's offense is really terrific. I thought they made some nice little adjustments. You know, they have some parts that you can switch between attack and midfield. A guy like Connor Cannizzaro can play both. Wesley Berg can play both. Eric Adamson can play both. Zach Miller can play both. The only guy who really can't is Jack Bobzien. So they're going to always be able to create matchups that are in their favor. And so scoring goals was never an issue. The face-off game and the face-off stats in that game, I think, were the most alarming thing, where Duke only won, what, 2 of the last 19 face-offs or something like that. And it's a Duke defense, 3 sophomores starting down below, a goaltender who's never really proven himself, and they're victimized. And that was never the case. Honestly, the most positive thing I take away from that game, Duke's offense did a great job scoring 13 goals against the Denver defense that was supposed to be taking a step forward this season. But quite honestly, watching that game, Carson Cannon and this Denver defense, just a bunch of guys. I didn't see anything there. You know, you think about the possessions and the amount of Duke goals. That's still a serious concern if you're a fan of Denver lacrosse, because the offense, as advertised, unbelievable, smoking, amazing. But the defense gave up a lot of goals on a few possessions.
Quint, Syracuse at last look was manhandling Cornell. They'll play an Army team next week who has put up a lot of goals, 44 in their first two games, so only 7 goals given up. What is the limit for this Army team?
I don't know yet. You know, John Glester said, obviously, is a great player. He's a charismatic player. He can play midfield or attack. They're getting really good face-off work right now from Daly. I like their goalie, Sam Summers, who was hurt at the end of last year where he tore his meniscus. I just watched that Syracuse game. They beat Cornell 14-5. You know, that's not a fair competition. Anytime you play an Ivy League team, first game of their season, they've only had 2 weeks of practice. You know, they open things up on Super Bowl Sunday, and here Syracuse is with their new indoor facility. So Syracuse is 3 or 4 or 5 weeks ahead of them. And Cornell's going to be good. I just worry about their depth of scoring. You know, Busek's a great player, and Donovan's a great player. We're shut down today. But after that, I'm not sure how much is there. But Cornell's an Ivy League-type championship-caliber team. And Syracuse, I was really impressed with their defense. I thought they didn't make very many mistakes. Brandon Mullins shut down Matt Donovan entirely. I thought their midfield defense was clean. But they cleared the ball well. I thought both Wardwell and Hill, when they got the goal, played great. So first midfield did most of the damage for Syracuse. I didn't see much coming off the bench in terms of production. And we know what that first attack can do. So I was impressed. I thought they were good. I thought they were sharp. I thought they played with good spirit and hustle. And it's everything you wanted to see from a Syracuse team this early in the season.
Quint, I want to take a look at the giant killers so far throughout the first 2 weeks of NCAA lacrosse, and that is the Golden Eagles of Marquette, taking down Lehigh last week, then this week with a final-minute goal to move up against Hofstra. The second straight year they've beaten the Pride. I don't think Coach Amplo has lost to his former team since he took over in Milwaukee. Is it time for us to start putting Marquette away from that underdog spot and start seeing them as a legitimate contender? Maybe not against Denver in the Big East, but against the remainder of the field?
I think it is, because, you know, it took me I had the same exact reaction that you had today. Okay, here's Marquette. Okay, let me refresh my memory. How long have they been playing? You know, is it 4 years? Is it 5 years? Is it 3 years? So I went back and I pulled it up today, you know, for my poll tomorrow. Well, they started in 2013. They competed as an independent. They weren't in the Big East that year. They're 5-8, which is pretty good. Remember, Michigan went varsity really early. Marquette had a year to develop their roster, and they didn't go varsity right away, and so they held back, and that's why they weren't, you know, 0-14 playing with club players in their first year. They're 5-8. Last year they were 6-10. They were in the Big East. They beat Hofstra. They beat Georgetown. They beat St. John's. They beat Rutgers, and that's unbelievable. In for year two, or two and a half, or three, whatever you want to call it, to beat those quality teams. And so what they've done now with wins over Lehigh and Hofstra, a Lehigh team that's really shorthanded, losing their 3 players. I did not have Lehigh as a top 20 team, not even remotely close. They're not in my poll. You know, they get credit for beating them, but Lehigh's not top 20 this year. Hofstra is the big enigma. Everyone wants to put them, you know, I think I had them somewhere 11, 12, 13. Hyping them up pretty good, and again, they disappoint. So Marquette's good. Under Coach Amplo, they've been playing since 2013, and you know, all of a sudden they got great players, and they're winning ball games, and they have an interesting game next week. I believe they play Richmond next weekend.
And that Richmond squad also off to a very good start, and maybe the class of the new Southern Conference, Quint.
Same deal. You know, they're a third-year program. They were 6-11 last year. They won the Atlantic Sun title, and that was kind of an upset when they beat High Point in the finals. No one expected them to beat them. They did. They went on, and they played in the play-in game in the NCAA tournament against Air Force and lost. So, you know, I'm not sure of the semantics of the situation. Do we give them an NCAA tournament bid or not? Well, they were in the play-in game. But they beat St. Joe's, and they dominated Rutgers. I got him ranked somewhere in, you know, around the 20 number. You have to right now. They're just winning ball games. They play Marquette and Richmond next week. And so that should be interesting. I think the winner of that game stays in the top 20, and the loser will fall out.
So we've got a lot of younger programs that are starting to make a name for themselves and maybe jumping into the top 25. A team that I want to look at, more established, sitting at number 10, is Maryland. And, I mean, talk about the adversity that they've had to face before the first whistle even, losing guys to graduations, transfers, suspensions, grades, you name it. They opened up this week. They beat Navy 8-1. What are your thoughts on this squad and the with them missing so many players?
Well, I think there's a certain toughness there. You know, you hold Navy to one goal. It's the first time since 1999 that Navy's been held to one goal, and Navy shot one of 27. You know, 27 shots sounds like enough. Just Navy never got to the inside, never got to the paint, and many of those shots were just off of dodges where guys were covered well. And so Maryland's goalie, he's a lefty. He's a first-year starter. Kyle Burnmore just benefited from that, and he could see his confidence build and build and build. So it was a nice start. It was a nice start for Maryland team that I'm not sure what they have on offense. I like their defense with Casey Ikeda and Matt Dunn. Charlie Raffa, believe it or not, their faceoff guy, kind of struggled. And I'm thinking the new rules had something to do with that. He only won 4 of 11 faceoffs. So, again, that's a pretty good sign. We only win, a guy like Raffa only wins 4 of 11, and you win 8-1. So I think we know what's there. It's interesting. I look at the ACC this year, and I see a lot of offensive teams. You know, Duke's going to score a lot of goals. Not sure they can defend. Virginia going to score a lot of goals. Not sure they can defend. Maryland's a team that defense is going to come first, and so that's going to be an interesting matchup every time that they, you know, step foot on the field. You know, Carolina can score goals like they're going out of style. Not sure they can defend. So Maryland kind of sticks out in that crowd because they can play defense.
Quint, you mentioned Virginia and their offense and their struggling defense. How much of that struggling defense is attributed to the loss of Tanner Scales this year?
Well, I mean, if you thought about, if you had to isolate one player on that roster that you couldn't lose, that would be the guy. Because offensively, you're really good. You got Ryan Lukovic. You have, you know, James Pinnell. You got Owen Van Arsdale. You got Ryan Tucker. You got the young Mitty Emery. You got a lot, you know, Zed Williams. You got a lot of options offensively. It's a really good offensive team. I mean, a really good offensive team. Their two weaknesses, faceoffs, goaltending, and defense. And now you're starting a completely inexperienced group. You gave up 10 goals to Drexel. You gave up 12 to Loyola. And it's just not a good matchup in that league. How are they going to cover North Carolina? How are they going to cover Duke? You know, how are they going to cover Notre Dame and Matt Kavanaugh? So I like Virginia's offense. If I'm their coaching staff, I'm playing a complete transition style lacrosse where I want the score to be 20-21 because the more opportunities, the better. And if they settle and slow things down, I just don't see it happening. So it's going to be a challenge for Virginia down the road, stopping good teams from scoring.
Quint, last question for you. I'm looking at Mike Pressler's Bryant Bulldogs starting the season 0-2. They get Hartford next week, but then they get Albany, Yale, Drexel, and Carolina. Is this a team in a lot of trouble?
No, I think it still comes down to them winning their automatic qualifier. I think that was always the case. You know, what I do see here is a case of a team that's had some success from last season, postseason success with that Syracuse win. They probably, you know, started to think of themselves. Not, I know Coach Presser's not that way, but the student athletes, it's only natural that you start to think of yourself as being a really good team. You know, that hasn't been a perfect program in the past. If you look at their record in the past, they've lost games all along the line that you'd say, well, I thought Bryant was getting good. You know, last year, every time that I thought they turned the corner, they would lose a game. You know, it was one step forward, two steps back. They lost to Yale in early March. They lose to St. Joe's in April. They lose to Brown in April. So they took positive steps and then steps back. Now, this year's situation, it looks like the offense is just not where it needs to be. You only score 5 goals against Colgate and then 5 goals against Cornell. So that seems to be the issue. A lot of turnovers in both their games. Bad clearing. You know, you want to blame the weather. You want to blame lack of practice. They're still a work in progress, and I think Coach Pressler knows what he's doing. And obviously winning their AQ out of the Northeast Conference, the NEC, is what matters. They got some tough games coming up, though. You mentioned Hartford. After that, take a look at it. Albany, at Yale, at Drexel, at North Carolina. That's brutal. Let's say they beat Hartford. They could lose four in a row after that. They could be 1-6 in early March with that schedule.
Yeah, they absolutely could. Quint, we sure appreciate your time, and we'll look forward to talking to you again in a few weeks.
Guys, great job by the Pioneers this week. Very exciting, and hope to talk to you in the future.
Super.
Thanks, Quint.
Quint Kasnick joining us.
Welcome back to the Dog Show. Up next,
you're listening to Lacrosse Talk on the Lax Worm Radio Experience. When we come back, it'll be all MCLA with Trey Lanthier.
Next, we have Satchmo. Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group. That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and, of course, companionship. And what breed would you say Satchmo is? I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier-hound-chihuahua-looking kind of mix. Tremendous dog. I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle, simply marvelous. You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this. Now, let's see him in action. Look how he makes eye contact with his person. That's actually known as the treat stare. How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles. Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group. And finally, the loving face lick. It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks. Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one. Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and theshelterpetproject.org.
Me, a cat, moving in with a new human. It took a little getting used to. She has these weird games she likes to play, like this giant feather. She sticks it in my face. I swat it away. She sticks it in my face. I swat it away. It's almost like she thinks I enjoy it. But seeing how much fun she gets out of it, well, I guess it makes it all worth it. Humans.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and theshelterpetproject.org.
Better piece of guitar work than this song out there. Eric Johnson and Cliffs of Dover. I am Dan Matthews with Max Rader. You're listening to Lacrosse Talk, North America's first and most comprehensive show dedicated to the sport of lacrosse. And we're right here, live and in person, on the Lax Worm Radio Experience. And it's great to be on the Lax Worm Radio Experience. And it's even better to bring in our next guest, Trey Lanthier, our MCLA insider, probably somewhere in the California desert making his way back to Tempe, Arizona. Am I right, Trey?
Actually, believe it or not, still on the UCLA campus. That Arizona-Oregon State game just ended, and I got my time zones mixed up. I forgot that the show would be at this time, considering I'm on Arizona time for the usual. But I'm here. Common sense kicked in.
I got to ask you, because everybody was panicked as the season got underway when they looked at number 2 ranked Arizona State and said, okay, what do we make of this team? They didn't play well in fall ball. They went to Whittier last week and got absolutely waxed by Whittier. and they came out this weekend, and they looked like the old Arizona State Sun Devils.
Yeah, it was pretty incredible. I was watching those last two games they played out here. I'd heard about the Whittier game and had been following that one. And I got to tell you, the biggest thing this is an indicator for is that Joe Thone can coach. You talk about suffering a loss like the one they did, 20-7. I've never heard of a turnaround that drastic to be able to come back from that game, build up the guys' confidence, and come out looking the way they did. I mean, beating Cal 14-6 and then beating Stanford even worse, 17-4. You know, these aren't a top-tier MCLA opponents, and nobody's making them out to be. But this is exactly what the ASU of old would have looked like. This is exactly what Coach Malone's team would have looked like coming out here. And it's a much different vibe around ASU lacrosse today than it was a couple days ago.
You said yourself that these two teams are not teams that are top-ranked material. Nevertheless, they've been at the dance in the last couple of years, both Stanford and Cal have. So they're no strangers to the national tournament. And ASU really came out and made a statement and said, okay, boys, this is the way it's going to be, and we're not going to be the team that played against Whittier. However, on the flip side of the coin, you've got the University of Colorado still playing their scrimmages, and one of those scrimmages against D2 Mesa yesterday, down Division II Mesa 13-11. How good is this University of Colorado squad going to be?
You know, reports from Colorado are saying that they're going to be pretty, pretty darn good. They've got two Maryland transfers, and I think what a lot of people are overlooking in this Colorado team is the amount of returners that they have. And, you know, everybody's looking at the big-time losses that this offense suffered, and the fact that Mitch Fenton is no longer in front of the cage, but also Jack Cranston, Riley Seidel. These are guys who are no longer on last year's championship-winning team. But the fact is, John Galvin still a very capable coach. He's been restocking ever since he got there. And this Colorado team should be right back on top coming into this regular season, and they proved that against Mesa.
Dan, I was hoping that you'd be keeping my Mavs out of the show today. Thank you for
not a chance.
Trey, I appreciate you coming on the show. I'm glad common sense kicked in. Talk about the rest of the games that are going on in the Pac-12 shootout that you are out on the campus of UCLA for.
Well, we got to see a lot of USC, and I liked what I saw from them. I think USC, they handled Washington, and then they were able to beat Cal. And remember, a couple days ago, Cal was ranked number 23 in the country, even though they had lost to Santa Clara in overtime in their opener. And people were expecting them to come out really angry against ASU and USC, and instead they dropped both of those games. But a big win for USC, and I think Coach Chris Boland has really done a good job with what he's dealt with on that team. And then I like what I saw from Oregon State. They handled Utah yesterday, which obviously isn't that impressive, but then they beat Arizona just a few moments ago in a very tight one. It was actually a commanding lead throughout. They're up 8-3 heading into the fourth quarter. Ended up having to hold on by the skin of their teeth to win that one 8-7. But that shows me that this is a team that might contend in the PNCLL that people have been overlooking. And then just talking about Arizona, they crushed Oregon, and then this game against Oregon State, obviously a letdown. None of their top goal scorers were really contributing until very late in that game. And I don't know what was going on, if maybe they just had a late night or what happened with Arizona, but I don't like to see that. And then Stanford 0-2, losing to Cal, losing to ASU. Now, obviously ASU loss should be expected, but they lost to UCLA. And I think UCLA is a team that Stanford has to beat in their season opener, and they weren't able to come away with that.
Trey, NAU and Fort Lewis squared off yesterday in Albuquerque, and Fort Lewis came out on top. How vital is this game to their individual races?
It's huge. It's huge. I mean, these are both teams that can contend within their divisions, with Fort Lewis being in the RMLC, NAU being in the SLC. They're teams that were 9-win teams a year ago, and granted, they didn't end up in the big tournament, but still, the fact that they were obviously putting together quality seasons means a lot. And Fort Lewis didn't just beat NAU; they really handled them. They handed the wood to them. It was 18-7. I don't know what happened to NAU. I was expecting a lot different of a result in this game, at least a much closer result, and it didn't quite fare out that way as Fort Lewis had the upper hand throughout that one.
So, Trey, you mentioned before the PNCLL and how Oregon State, with a statement win today over Arizona, might be a contender in there. I want to talk about Simon Fraser and the win that they put together against Dominican. The three teams that played each other, Dominican, Sonoma State, and Simon Fraser, all split 1-1 between the three. Talk about what you see with Simon Fraser in their win over Dominican.
Well, I think Simon Fraser proved that they can keep up with a high-scoring game. And a lot of people were questioning that because you lose guys like Ward Spencer. You lose guys like Tyler Kirkby, who's out for the season with injury. And a lot of you were wondering, can this offense still keep up with some of the best in the league? And Dominican, I wouldn't say one of the best offenses in the league, but still putting up 16 against Simon Fraser, and they had to go into overtime to win that one 17-16. So I think Simon Fraser really has proven that they can score. But then they turn right around and lose to Sonoma State in a much different style of game. I think it was 11-8 was the final. I'm not sure what to take away from this weekend. I think that you want to come away 2-0. You split the game, so it's okay, but it's hard to take away anything super positive because Simon Fraser is still going to have to play in a very competitive PNCLL, and these were big out-of-conference games for them.
Trey, Georgia Tech had a big win on Friday night against Vanderbilt. Central Florida had likewise a similar victory against Vanderbilt. But then Georgia Tech really took it to Central Florida in their matchup against each other. How is this Georgia Tech team overcoming some adversity in what happened with Coach Lovick at Georgia Tech last week in putting together what looks like it's going to be a very quality season?
Well, for one thing, they're shaking up the SCLC. A lot of people were pointing at Virginia Tech, Florida State, Liberty as teams that were going to contend out of this conference. And Georgia Tech wasn't getting much love. They did end up in the top 25, but right on the tail end of that. And nobody really knew what to expect out of the Yellow Jackets. And so far, they've looked great. I do think that controversy around Lovick may have actually helped them. I think that you play a little angry when people start calling out your coach, and you definitely have some incentive to succeed. And they've proven that they have what it takes to succeed in a very deep SELC. And so far they've looked awesome. And I think the win today was by far one of the most important they've won all year. UCF, a very quality team that could sneak into the SELC tournament and really do some damage there, but I think that beating them 10-1 is just another great example. This Georgia Tech defense is scary. Everyone should be watching out. Matt Sommerfeld, one of the best goalies in the league, and he continues to dazzle with the numbers he puts up.
Trey, let's keep it in the South, and let's take a look at a team that would, in any other sport, be in the SEC, but in lacrosse, they're putting the LSA, and that's going to be Louisiana State, LSU, starting off the season 4-0. I don't think we've ever brought LSU up on this show one time, but I think it's worth mentioning the fact that they're undefeated right now.
Yeah, but it's the first time for everything. And LSU, you're right, hasn't gotten much national exposure. Nobody's really ever paid much attention to the lacrosse program, and with good reason. They've never really had many successful seasons. And the fact that, you know, nobody really even knew they were on the LSA until a couple days ago or until they started this season this way is telling. But they have started very well. They started 4-0, and it's not just the fact that they started 4-0. It's the way that they've done it, the opponents they've done it against, and I think there's a lot to be said for the dominating performances they put up. I really like their win over Texas A&M, and I like it a lot more now that Texas A&M has beaten Texas State. I think that goes much further in proving where the LSU lies in the conference, because the LSA usually goes to Texas. Texas State looked like this year might be the year, and now all of a sudden, LSU might be the favorite in the LSA.
Wow. those are big words. And words
I know, I would not say them otherwise. I would not say them if I didn't believe them.
Trey, there's one team that I really don't want to talk about the one team. BYU went down to San Diego State early in the week. They rebounded with a huge win against UNLV yesterday. But what does it mean for San Diego State to have knocked off BYU, and what does it mean to the rest of the SLC?
It's huge. It's huge. And it's just another telling story of how the SLC is at the very least the second best conference in the country, if not the best. The RMLC always going to be going back and forth with the SLC on that one. But San Diego State beating BYU. And the thing is, people look at the box score and think, oh, they pulled out a narrow one. But that's not the case. They were up 7-1 at one point. San Diego State was manhandling BYU until very late, when I'm sure they were getting conservative and started to give up points to a well-coached team. So BYU dropping that game, a lot of people are focusing on what does it mean for BYU. I think if you look at it from the San Diego State perspective, it's a huge win. And in the SLC South, which is already so crowded, you've already got GCU in there, you've got ASU, Arizona, and now San Diego State entering that mix as a possibly ranked team. That's a hard division to come up with a title in, and I think that road to that title may be forming a contender.
Trey, last question for you. I want to go back to the point tracker that we started last week, and that's going to be with Casey Glad for UT Dallas, one of the newer programs here. He was at 37 points through three games. I'm not sure what he got over this past week, but just – Is he the front runner right now as the Go to Craw winner for Division II?
Well,
big points.
Yeah, I mean he does have 37 points through three games. We haven't yet gotten the official box score from the Sam Houston State game. They lost that one 16-10. It was their first loss in program history, but this is their first year. And I think yes. And I got a chance to talk to Casey Gladden. This is a guy who played NCAA before. It's not often you see guys go from the NCAA levels to eventually playing D2, but what ended up happening was, you know, he played NCAA maybe 4 years ago, and things, you know, life happened. And so ends up getting his shot at redemption when UT Dallas starts up a team. Hey, it's a good story. It's a good story, and it's a guy who has a lot of potential. He's been a midfielder his whole career, now getting to play attack, and he's a great player. He's a great player. He's putting up great totals. But also, he's helping the guys around him. He's really leading that team. And I think that UT Dallas is going to be something of a contender in the LSA D2 because of him. And so, yes, I would say right now, just with the sheer statistical significance of the numbers he's posting, I mean, nearly 13 points a game is incredible, no matter which level you're playing. I don't care if you're playing against high school JV players. It's pretty impressive. So, big start to the season for him, and I would say he's a front runner at the moment.
Trey, we appreciate it. You have passed round two of your exam, and we'll look forward to round three next week. And as the season really gets underway full bore, because I know that both Colorado and Colorado State will be in action down in Texas. So there will be plenty of talk on MCLA lacrosse next week.
All right, guys. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks, Trey. Safe travels.
Thank you.
That's Trey Lanthier, our MCLA insider. When we come back, we'll take the game indoors and talk to Brian Shanahan about the National Lacrosse League. You're listening to Lacrosse Talk on the Laxworm Radio Experience.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
So, I'm a dog, and I just got adopted by this new human guy, and I'm starting to wonder how he got along without me. Okay, something as simple as walking around the block. He's got this leash thing, and he puts me on one end and him on the other, and I'm just taking him around. I think he's afraid of getting lost. Without that leash and me guiding him along, I don't think he'd find his way back home. But it's kind of cute.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
It's Thursday night, and you're grabbing drinks with some friends. Started off with a pitcher for the table, which quickly becomes two. There's pool. And there's the photo booth.
All right, everybody, squeeze in. Say cheese!
Followed naturally by an order of wings. And another.
Can we get some extra ranch sauce?
Then there's the ceremonial nightcap.
So what are we doing this weekend?
And lastly, it's back to the car, which, if you're buzzed...
could be the most expensive night of your life. Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
If you want to replace those public service announcements with commercials for your own business, contact me, Dan Matthews, at dan@laxvision.com to be a sponsor of Lacrosse Talk or the Laxworm Radio Experience. We can't encourage you enough to become a part of what we think will be something huge. Max, we're going to take the game indoors now, and I know that the Edmonton Rush have probably wrapped up their game, and Shanny will be able to update us on that. And at the same time, the Rochester Nighthawks just about to get underway as they take on the New England Black Wolves. Hi, Shanny. How are you?
Not bad, guys. How about you guys?
Doing well. Shanny, you said it last week that we are going to be looking at the Edmonton Rush as the team that will be the one that comes out on top with a big sweep, not the Minnesota Swarm. And sure enough, the Rush played huge this weekend against the Mammoth.
Yeah, once in a while I'm correct, and I was correct this weekend. Yeah, Edmonton swept the Colorado in that battle for first place. So you're right, Edmonton and Colorado just finished their game shortly a little while ago. The final score was 13-7. For Edmonton, and on Friday, Edmonton beat Colorado 11-7. So that sweep puts them into first place and drops Colorado actually into a tie for second place with Vancouver, who won on the weekend. And you mentioned on the other side in the East Division, we had Minnesota and Toronto, and Toronto swept that series, beating Minnesota 16-4 on Friday, and I think it was 14-9 on Saturday. So no change in first place in the East, but a change in the West with Edmonton. And really, I guess we shouldn't be totally surprised because, that's where we thought Edmonton would be before the season started. I think the bigger surprise was the fact that Edmonton got off to an 0-2 start, but, now they're, 4-2, and they look like, they look like the team we all expected them to be.
And, Brian, both home-and-home series were sweeps this week. Taking a look at the other division, though, with Toronto, Minnesota, wasn't even close. First game, Toronto goes into the Xcel Energy Stadium, puts the beat down 16-4, and then back in Toronto, they win again 14-9. What happened to Minnesota's offense? They're coming off a huge overtime win against Rochester last week and then just lay a dud this week.
Well, I really think, the credit goes to Toronto. I watched both of those games, and on Friday, Toronto's defense was just stifling. And I don't think it was so much, even though Toronto scored 16 goals, I don't think it was so much their offense woke up. I think it was that their defense gave Minnesota absolutely nothing, really did beat them down. And they also had good goaltending, Toronto did, from Brandon Miller. And on the other side of the coin, neither Zach Higgins or Brody McDonald played well for Minnesota. So it was a statement weekend for the Toronto Rock. I think a lot of people thought, here's Minnesota's chance to, possibly take first place, but at least make it close. And they weren't in it at all. And even in Toronto the next night, Minnesota played better, but really it never really felt too close. At times early in the game, Minnesota got the lead, but Toronto pulled ahead by three or four goals, and it never seemed to be threatened at all. Minnesota would score a few here and there, but Toronto really did cruise to a 14-9 victory. So I think they sort of put a statement out there that they are definitely, the top team in the East at this point in the season. So I think if anyone was expecting something from Minnesota, I think, even watching the game in Minnesota, listening to Minnesota local announcers, and I think they gave all props to Toronto, and they said, this is a learning experience for that young Minnesota team. If they thought they were going to give Toronto a battle, they've got a long way to go.
Well, and interesting enough, Shanny, the Swarm now find themselves at the bottom of the Eastern Division with those two losses, and not a place that they're unfamiliar with because they spent most of last year there. But how does this young Minnesota Swarm team rebound as they look up at the rest of the season?
Well, it really is tough because, as you said, I'm sure they're coming into the weekend thinking, hey, we've got a chance for first place, and then suddenly they're on the bottom looking up, and things could change that quickly in the NLL, you know, especially when you play two games in a weekend and you know, and the teams behind you are winning. Rochester beat Buffalo on Saturday, and they're playing New England right now, so Rochester has a chance to move up as well. So it's just the way it is in the NLL. You can move from, you know, battling for first down to the bottom, especially this early in the season. And I think, you know, the Minnesota has to do what they've done so far this season is just take it one game at a time. And actually, up to this point, like, Minnesota had not lost two games in a row yet this season, you know, until this weekend. So I think they just have to shake it off and come in to the next game just thinking about, you know, that game only. I believe that – I think they even have next weekend off, so they will have some time to regroup. Now, Calum Crawford, their top scorer, went down hurt in the second Toronto game. I haven't heard the report, but, you know, he was in the stands for about half of that game, so it must have been serious enough that he couldn't complete the game. So that could be key if he's hurt for any length of time.
Brian, Minnesota back at the bottom of the standings as they were last year. Vancouver, another team that was considerably the worst team in the NLL, close to matching their win total in total from last year with their win over it was Calgary. The Roughnecks, 0-6. I mean, is it time to put them to bed as far as playoff chances go?
No, but if they don't win next week, I think it might be. It's absolutely shocking that every week we're saying this about Calgary, that they still haven't got a win. Their 0-3 start was their worst start in history, and they're 0-6 now, and they pretty much have the same team that went to the finals last year. It's incredible that they're finding different ways to lose each week. And, you know, I'll give Vancouver credit. Vancouver, I think, has turned it around the last couple of games. And, you know, and it's sad to say, but it coincides with Lewis Ratcliffe, you know, leaving the lineup. I think a lot of people felt that Lewis Ratcliffe, you know, one of the great veterans, one of the, you know, top scorers in the NLL over the last 10 years. But I think a lot of people felt that he just was hurting the chemistry, especially after bringing in, you know, a young guy like Johnny Paulus. And Johnny Paulus really wasn't getting to handle the ball enough with Ratcliffe out there. And I think a lot of those people were probably correct, because when they took Ratcliffe out of the lineup, the chemistry changed. They had a great game a couple weeks ago. They had last week off. Lewis Ratcliffe surprised me, at least, by announcing his retirement. You know, Vancouver, again, this weekend looked pretty good, you know, in beating Calgary. So right now, you know, Calgary's 0-6. They've lost twice to Vancouver, so they play each other again next week. If they go 0-7, you know, with three losses out of the four games against Vancouver, it's going to become very difficult for them to get a playoff spot. I know you can win three games in a row quite quickly, but, yeah, they would need to go on a run, you know, to have a chance for the playoffs. So I think next weekend is absolutely do or die for the Calgary Roughnecks. And having said that, their next opponents are Rochester and Edmonton twice. So if they don't get that win next week, and I don't see things getting any easier for them after that.
Shanny, last question for you. How would you assess the Black Wolves and where they stand at this point in the season?
Well, I think they're pretty much where we thought they would be, maybe even doing a little better than we thought they would be. They're 2-2 coming into the weekend. You know, and they got pretty good upsets. You know, they got a victory against Rochester and a victory against Buffalo, you know, to start the season. And I think that surprised a lot of people. They lost their next two games. I would be shocked if Rochester didn't beat them today. You know, Rochester's in New England today. When I last looked, it was actually 4-4. Even though Rochester took a 3-0 lead, New England has battled back, but I still think Rochester is the much better team. But that's no slight on New England. We expected them to be a fairly inexperienced team, and I think, you know, we all expected them to be on the outside looking in. But, yeah, so far I think they have to be mildly pleased with their start, but I just don't see it lasting. I think, you know, when the season ends, they're going to be more than a few games below 500.
Shanny, as always, we appreciate it, and we'll look forward to chatting with you next week right here on Lacrosse Talk.
Excellent, guys. We'll talk to you later. Take care.
Thanks, Brian.
It's Brian Shanahan, our NLL insider, joining us on Lacrosse Talk. We're going to go without a break here and shift gears, and we're going to take it from the men's side to the women's side, and our women's insider, Hallie Quillen. Hi, Hallie. How are you tonight?
Hi, good. How are you?
Doing outstanding, Hallie. The Colorado Buffaloes have gotten off to an auspicious start, if you will. Probably not their best performance last week, but really looked good this week against Marquette.
Yeah, no, I mean, Colorado came out very strong against Denver. You know, I actually think both goalkeepers and Hannah Hook and Paige played incredibly well, and I think that's going to be what we see throughout the rest of the season from the two of them. You know, against Marquette, I was able to watch the game, and I was so impressed with the way that this team played. I think that once Marquette kind of really held Johns Hopkins to a close game, Johns Hopkins needed overtime to beat Marquette last week. Marquette made a statement. You know, they're a new program, much like Colorado, but, you know, they're going to challenge the top teams. So for Colorado to come back in that game to make a statement, they handled them pretty easily. So not only was Colorado's defense firing on all cylinders, holding Marquette to just five, you know, their offense easily put up 13 goals.
Allie, thank you for joining us on the show. I want to look at the big matchup of the weekend that was between Northwestern and Virginia. It's hard to take away from these two teams just because it's so early in the season, but Northwestern has been tiptoeing the line the past 2 weeks, eking out their wins over USC and Virginia by one. What do you take away from the big-time matchup yesterday?
You know, I think I take a few things away. You know, first and foremost, Northwestern without Alyssa Leonard is a team that's struggling on the draw circle. Northwestern was outdrawn yesterday. Courtney Swan did a great job for Virginia. You know, they picked up, I think it was 9-4 or 9-5 in the draw margin in Virginia's favor. So Northwestern is no longer a team that can really rely on dominating possession. You know, I think in watching that game, Virginia wanted to slow it down. You know, they don't have a problem holding the ball for 4 or 5 minute offensive possessions. You know, they slowed it down, really working for that offensive flow. And Northwestern, a team that, you know, we've seen in the past also, they're not afraid to slow it down and be deliberate offensively either. So for two very talented teams, it was an extremely low-scoring game. But it was an exciting matchup. You know, I think perennial powers going against one another. You know, it was a huge game. And, you know, Northwestern once again proved this is a team that traditionally just knows how to eke it out in those one-goal games. You know, more often than not, they're on the winning side of those battles.
Hallie, for those that are new to women's lacrosse and really just trying to get a feel for the landscape of women's lacrosse, where should they turn? What are the programs they should be watching kind of on a regional basis in their neck of the woods?
You know, I think it's truthfully, you know, I think it's, you know, on our InSev across scoreboard this year, we have utilization to show you which program is live streaming that game. You know, if you were to tell me 4 or 5 years ago, the Pac-12, the SEC, the Big South, they were live streaming lacrosse games to where lacrosse fans that are really all over. You know, it's not just the ACC anymore. You know, so many conferences and so many schools are putting this footage on their websites. It might not be on TV, but lacrosse fans from all over. You know, if you want to see a game, more often than not, you can watch it on your computer, which is huge. So I think if lacrosse fans are new to the sport or they just want to learn more about women's lacrosse, you know, obviously on our website we have a lot of live streaming information. In addition to just most teams' websites for their university, you know, the majority of games that I've actually seen thus far this season. You know, as there's been quite a few, I haven't seen them in person. It's been via live stream, and it's been on my computer, and that's pretty incredible.
Allie, as I look up and down the scoreboard for women's lacrosse over the course of this past weekend, I only see a small handful of games that were real competitive. Are there games that I'm missing when I look at the scoreboard that are typically being played better than what that score might indicate?
You know, I think that, you know, there were a few close games this weekend. You know, Northwestern Virginia 6-5, it was right down to the wire. I'm trying to think, let's see, it was Cortland, they played in a blizzard up north yesterday. They won in overtime. And also Oregon High Point went into 9-8. You know, there were some close games. I think earlier in the season you're less apt to see these battles between big teams or, you know, even conference rivals going head-to-head. You know, I think as the season progresses, you'll see games get a little bit closer. But then, you know, a week ago in our IL game day, we were down in Gainesville, Florida, and Florida played UNC, and it was a battle throughout. It was a close game. Towards the end, Florida really had to pressure out. They changed their defensive style because they needed to get the ball back. So in pressuring out, you know, well past the 12-meter arc, you know, North Carolina had a few kind of layups towards the end. So I think you can see that in certain games. But I think as the season progresses, you'll see once conference play starts, I think those scores will get a little bit tighter.
One team that doesn't have to worry about weather is Syracuse, since they're playing in the Carrier Dome. Taking a look at their game against Canisius, they put up 19-7. We even watched the men's game earlier before this show. Extremely high-powered offense. You have mentioned on Lacrosse Talk before that Kayla Traynor is one of your favorite players just because of her all-around skill abilities. Does Syracuse have the best offense in women's lacrosse?
You know, the best offense in women's lacrosse, I think that's a very high praise for such a new offense. You know, I think North Carolina might be the most potent offense I've seen so far this season, though it's still very early. You know, I think Syracuse is just a new look attack. Alyssa Murray graduated as one of probably the best players to ever play at Syracuse across any position. And it was a bit of a question mark who was going to step up next to Kayla Traynor this year. And Hallie Majorana transferred in from Maryland, where she had, you know, some great success as a role-playing attacker there. And Riley Donahue, actually, Dylan Donahue on the men's lacrosse team, his younger sister, is a freshman and is one of their leading scorers through their first three games. So, you know, I think it's a new offense, but I don't think we'll see the best lacrosse offense until farther down when the Syracuse team does take on Maryland. They do take on Florida. They do take on North Carolina and some of those other high-powered offenses.
Hallie, women's lacrosse is it's not a new sport, but it's new to a lot of people, and you're using terms that, while Max and I may understand them, the average listener may not. We talk about the draw versus the face-off. Can you explain the differences between the two and how objectively a one team would win the draw?
So the draw and the face-off are, you know, pretty noticeably different, whereas the face-off, the ball starts on the ground, and the draw is actually positioned between two players' sticks in the upright position off the ground. So it's actually the players, their sticks, the crosses are turned away from one another, and that ball is positioned right in the back, and there are three players on the circle, one taking the draw, and then two other, kind of, you know, what we see now, they're almost positioned as draw teams. A lot of people put special units out there on the field. And once that whistle goes, I mean, the draw is up. I mean, today, you know, I think Taylor Cummings picked up 9 self-draws to herself against William and Mary. So there are certain players, Alyssa Leonard, who played for Northwestern last year, Taylor Cummings, who's at Maryland this year. There's certain players that have kind of mastered that craft of just putting the ball up in the air or putting the ball away from anyone else and getting it themselves. But just as crucial as those players are, you know, the teams around them on the circle are huge, much like the wing players in men's lacrosse. You know, if the person who's taking the face-off or the person who's taking the draw can get it into a certain direction, that's easier for their teammate to get it on the line or on the circle. You know, that's huge as well. So it's, you know, it's pretty much the same theme in men's lacrosse. If you dominate the face-off battle, if you dominate the draw battle, you're putting your team in a very good position to win because it's all about position. But, you know, the actual draw and face-off are very different in and of themselves.
If I were making a comparison, Hallie, what I see is I see the men's face-off similar to that which we might see in hockey and the women's draw similar to that which we might see in basketball.
Yes, they're very similar.
Hallie, last question for you on a little bit more of a somber note. Duke's head women's lacrosse coach, Kirsten Kimmel, recently diagnosed and underwent surgery for breast cancer. She and the university also released a statement simultaneously, a humongous hit for any kind of program to have to deal with something like that. Who will be taking over for Coach Kimmel, and what, if anything, have you heard from the sidelines or from the girls on the field who are playing for Coach Kimmel?
You know, I think, you know, the release that we got, Coach Kimmel is going to move forward and coach her team. You know, that was the impression that I got from that statement. You know, Coach Kimmel, you know, basically came out and said, you know, she was so proud of the way that her girls handled that. You know, today, you know, Duke has hit the ground the way we thought they would in 2015. They're a really strong team. You know, when I saw that team play in the fall, you know, they were a Final Four contender, and I don't think that changes. You know, as anyone in the lacrosse community, that team and everyone who that team will face has tremendous respect and support for Kirsten Kimmel. You know, one thing that Duke asked was really to honor her privacy and support her during that time, and, you know, that's entirely what I plan on doing, and, you know, I hope the lacrosse community as a whole does as well.
Hallie, we sure appreciate it, and we'll look forward to talking more women's lacrosse in a couple of weeks.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Hallie.
That's Hallie Quillenen, our NCAA Women's Lacrosse Insider on Lacrosse Talk. When we come back, we'll chat with head coach Derek Keenan of the Edmonton Rush. You're listening to Lacrosse Talk, North America's first and most comprehensive show dedicated to the sport of lacrosse, right here on the Laxworm Radio Experience.
10,012 dollars. Please drive around.
10,000 what?
It's obvious you're buzzed and driving.
I've only had a few. I'm fine.
Yeah, the food's 12 bucks, but getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Please drive around. Actually, just park and come in.
Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
In 50 feet, turn left. Why are you driving so slowly?
After a few drinks, I'm taking it slow.
Well, you're not fooling the cop behind you.
What?
Get ready to pay in 0.1 miles.
Getting pulled over for buzz driving could cost you around $10,000 in fines, legal fees, and increased insurance rates. Nothing kills a buzz like getting pulled over for buzz driving, because buzz driving is drunk driving. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
Did you just look down at your phone? You did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me. Whatever it is, you'll live.
Learn more at StopTextStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration.
So, you know, I'm a dog, and I'm kind of new to this family, but I've noticed a trend. My humans do this thing where they go around and get all my toys and hide them in this basket. But it's always the same basket. And it's always the same place. And then they act so surprised when I find them. But I'm like, hello, that's where you put it last time. Humans are the worst at hide-and-go-seek.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Oh.
Welcome back to Lacrosse Talk on the Laxworm Radio Experience. Max Frater here with Dan Matthews. Second week of NCAA lacrosse underway. Ton of great games going on. The Cornell-Syracuse game finishing up as our show started, as well as some NLL games going on right here during the show as New England and Rochester are currently playing. But we have on the show right now Coach Derek Keenan from the Edmonton Rush, who just finished up his second straight game against the Colorado Mammoth and the second straight win, this one 13-7. Coach, we appreciate you joining us on the show right after the game today. Coach, are you with us? Looks like we might be having some technical difficulties with Coach Keenan, but regardless, the Edmonton Rush, as we had talked with Brian just a couple segments ago, beating Colorado this time 13-7 in Edmonton, and then beating the Mammoth at home here in Colorado, home for us at least. The Mammoth, coming off to a 3-0 start, have now dropped three straight, opening things up in the Western Division a little bit, with Edmonton taking these two in a row. So the Rush, not having quite the same start to the season as they did last year, but you can't ask to have a 14-0 start to every single season, right, Dan?
I agree 100%. It's not an easy process to have a season that you're going to start 14-0 and kind of roll the table until they ran into Calgary last year heading into the championship weekend.
And they only improved the offense from there. You pick up the young gun, Ben McIntosh, who has been nothing but stellar for the Rush since he's taken over and put on the black jersey. He struck first in this game with Edmonton against Colorado. Just taking a look at the stats here overall, had two goals in the game from what I can see just by taking a look at the box score. But, I mean, the way that these younger guys, and Ben coming from the NCAA ranks as well, so he was an outdoor guy jumping into the box leagues, had played box his whole life. But in my opinion, it seems a little bit more difficult for younger players to jump into indoor as opposed to the outdoor, just because of the spacing and the guys that are coming at you in indoor, a little bit rougher, I would say, than the guys that are coming at you, even with the 6-foot poles out in field ball.
Yeah, I agree 100%. And for those of you just tuning in, we're working right now to get a hold of Coach Derek Keenan, head coach of the Edmonton Rush. I've got a text message out to their media relations person, Pauline Hughes, who's very good at getting back to me, and we'll find out if we can get Coach Keenan on here momentarily. His team coming off two big wins over the Mammoth and overtaking first place in the West. And it's amazing to me, Max, how much difference a coach can make, because this team in the last 2 to 3 weeks since Coach Keenan came back has really responded.
Right, and it was the opposite trend that we were talking about with the Mammoth just before. Edmonton, it was Edmonton, Rochester, and Calgary, the three teams that made the playoffs last year, and they all came off to a rocky start. It was bizarre to see these really talented rosters just not being able to click, and then you see Edmonton, the light bulb goes off in their heads, and they start putting things together. They start stringing consecutive wins, and I'm sure you could attribute a lot of that to Coach Keenan being on the sidelines. He had to take a leave of absence due to some family health issues going on, and that's when Edmonton really struggled. Now he's back on the sidelines. Seems like there's a little bit more positivity there. And this weekend, above all, so far throughout the course of the season, was the biggest for the Rush, picking up two wins over division rivals.
Sure. They pick up those wins over the division rival. They overtake first place. And, it's remarkable to me that just a short period after Coach Keenan lost his wife to cancer, that he's back on the bench, and just a tribute to him and to his family, his kids, that he's there and he is coaching the squad. And I know that his wife would probably not want it any other way.
Just shows the dedication as well. I mean, when you're looking at National League lacrosse and it doesn't have, you know, the massive popularity as something like hockey, Saturday Night Hockey would in Canada. But still, his love for the game and his love for the team, I mean, I think that was just as hard for him stepping away to deal with everything that was going on in his life and stepping away from the sport and the team that he had put so much time and effort into rebuilding after the incredible season, the incredible run they had last year, ending in the semis in a mini game the first mini game of the playoffs. I mean, it must have been just crushing for those guys. So you know he wanted to come back, start things off right. Didn't go that way, but now he's back on the sidelines. Edmonton's clicking, and things are working well for the Rush right now, sitting alone in first place.
And really amazing how much that mini game came into play last year during playoff time. And I know that they've made some changes to the playoff system for this year. And I like the new system a little bit better. I like playing another full game better than playing 10 minutes. But I think that what we're looking at is just kind of the evolution of the playoff system for box lacrosse.
You see playoff evolution in box lacrosse. You see it in Division III lacrosse with them adding two more teams to the mix, which kind of just seems like it creates a little bit more chaos, but I think the more that you can add in, the better. Division II added a total of 8 teams to the playoff. Division I sitting at 16 with 2 play-in games now. So the field of lacrosse in all levels is growing. We just need to see some more teams pop up in the professional ranks as well as the Division I ranks.
Yeah, and I think that we're going to see more and more box lacrosse. I do think that the National Lacrosse League is looking at a process by which they need to expand. They've got this 18-game schedule that they're playing. They're playing it with just 8 teams in the league now, or 9 teams in the league. So, you know, you have an imbalance in teams playing each other, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that over the course of time, we'll see probably another team or two added into the mix before we change the way the schedule looks.
You hope so. I mean, you heard Shani say it just now when we were talking NLL ball. Vancouver and Calgary are going to play 4 times this year. And that's the same with everybody. I mean, there's a difference between, you know, playing the teams in your division a couple times to figure out who's going to be on top and how things are going to lay out for playoffs. But you play the same team 4 times in one season. I don't care how good you are, how much talent you have. If you've got that much film on the other team, I mean, the game's going to be 2-2 by the end of it, just because you know who the shooters are, you know their hot spots, you know where they like to be, what their plays are looking like. So I don't want to say that it diminishes from the game, but when you're playing the same guys 4 times in the same year, it gets a little redundant. You got to be able to switch things up. Like you said, add a new team to the mix. Love seeing New England in here, although they were formerly the Philly Wings. You know, switching up the scenery, switching up the mascots, and they're playing really well. So not necessarily a new team, but switching it up a little bit, it's good to see. We need to have a little bit more.
Yeah, unfortunately, it looks like Coach Keenan not able to join us. I know that he had a short gap between the end of the game and getting to the airport to catch a plane and get out of town. So we're going to go ahead and take a break. And when I'm being told that Coach is calling us now. So we may run a little bit overtime on tonight's show, and that's okay. If Coach calls us right this moment, we'll get a few words in with Coach Keenan of the Edmonton Rush. And then we will chat with head coach from the University of Detroit, Chris Colon, to wrap up the night.
Coach Colon, an interesting person to talk to as well with their huge win over Ohio State. I know during last week's show we talked a lot about the ranked teams falling down, with Marquette beating Lehigh and Bryant losing to Colgate, Loyola going down to Virginia, but that was one kind of in the side mix of things that we weren't really talking about. That was huge. It was the first program win for Detroit Mercy over Ohio State. And unfortunately, the Titans dropped one to Michigan in the battle for the glove state there. But I think it'll be cool to talk to Coach Colon and kind of see where the program is his first year there and a big win for the Titans.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the Titans are heading down the right path. Remember, it was just 2 years ago that they were in the playoffs and took Notre Dame to their limits. We had Coach there for just a moment and lost him. I think what we're going to do is go ahead and reschedule Coach. In the meantime, we're going to go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we'll talk with head coach Chris Colon of the University of Detroit Titans. You're listening to Lacrosse Talk on the Laxworm Radio Experience.
Satchmo is a member of the Shelter Pet Group. That's right, a group known especially for their couch-snuggling, ball-chasing, face-licking, tail-wagging, backyard-hanging, and, of course, companionship. And what breed would you say Satchmo is? I'd have to go with maybe a lavish terrier-hound-chihuahua-looking kind of mix. Tremendous dog. I'd also like to point out Satchmo's coloring, a white, gray, brown, black brindle. Simply marvelous. You know, it's such a treat to watch a dog like this. Now, let's see him in action. Look how he makes eye contact with his person. That's actually known as the treat stare. How intuitive. And now he appears to be excitedly turning in circles. Ah, the happy dance, so common with this group. And finally, the loving face lick. It's great how he just gets in there and, well, licks. Fantastic. But really, the best way to know an amazing shelter pet like Satchmo is to meet one. Visit theshelterpetproject.org today. Adopt. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
So I'm a cat, and I just moved in with this new human, and she's got this little toy she's always playing with, all day long. Tap, 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 bloop, bloop. She can't put it down. There it is. Oh, and get this. She even talks to it. Last week, she asked it for Chinese, and guess what? Egg rolls showed up, like magic. Humans have cool toys.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and theshelterpetproject.org.
Me, moving in with a new human. It took a little getting used to. She has these weird games she likes to play, like this giant feather. She sticks it in my face. I swat it away. She sticks it in my face. I swat it away. It's almost like she thinks I enjoy it. But seeing how much fun she gets out of it, well, I guess it makes it all worth it. Humans.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and theshelterpetproject.org.
Welcome back to Lacrosse Talk, North America's first and most comprehensive show dedicated to the sport. On the Laxworm Radio Experience, Max Frater here with Dan Matthews. And we are about to talk to the head coach of Detroit Titans, Chris Colon. And, Coach, you came off of a huge win last week for the program. You're first as the head coach for Detroit Mercy. Talk a little bit about that.
We were, the best team on that day. So our kids stuck to the plan and stayed pretty focused throughout it. And came up with a win. So that's what happened that week.
Coach, a little bit different outcome last night when you took on Michigan at Oosterbaan. What was the difference in the way your team played from week one to week two? And what can you take away from each of those games to build on for the rest of the season?
We're all in the office right now, and we're really focusing on Robert Morris. There was the good news is we have some good things that we did one week and some not so good things this week. So we're just going to continue with our corrections, get back to work on the little basics that we need to do, and prepare for Robert Morris. So that's what we're doing.
You're a former player of Detroit Mercy, took over as assistant coach for a while, but now the head honcho taking over for Matt Holtz. What's the difference between where you were at last year and now sitting in the big chair as the head coach?
I'm talking to you, I guess. That's probably one of the differences, right? I've got a great staff. I've got, Graham Adams as our offensive coordinator. You know, we have Jeff Turner, who actually came over from Michigan. He's great. Alex Manny, who was a former player. And A.J. LaBelle, who's been the goalie coach. So instead of kind of managing a group of players, I'm managing a great group of coaches and then they're, with their position group. So my approach is not that different, but, just, I guess, more people and a little bit different of approach. But it's just as fun for me, so.
Coach, talk a little bit about your recruiting process up at the University of Detroit. And are you a team that likes to start early, or are you a team that's picking up those kids that are waiting to commit? And who are some of the key players that you have found through your style of recruiting?
It's are we an early recruiter? I don't think we really are. You know, the landscape is changing so much where sometimes even, you know, like this year, 2015s weren't really even playing in the fall, so you're almost forced to early recruit more than I'd like to. But, you know, what we kind of do is if we can get kids on campus, Detroit has a little bit of a stigma. Once we get them on campus, we show our product, and we're very proud of our product, and people warm up very quickly. So, you know, for our challenge is really just getting them to the city, and once we get them in the city, they see the good stuff, we show them the bad stuff, and they see that's a pretty good place to grow. You know, we're starting to go into Indiana more than we have in the past. We're, you know, looking to Wisconsin. You know, traditionally we do pretty well in Long Island, we do pretty well in Ontario, and we do pretty well in our own state. We're looking forward to some of our Indiana kids that we're going to be getting in the future. With that and kind of our limited resource compared to some other bigger programs, we're kind of picking those places and sticking with them. So, you know, we're not going to be we have two kids from Dallas, or we have a kid from Dallas. We just had another kid from Dallas commit. So we're just kind of sticking in the areas that we can get to kind of in an economical way and see what we can get.
Coach, the MAAC is a very senior-laden conference as far as who the top performers are, who the guys who are leading the way for your teams. Who are the seniors on the Titans, that the names that we should know going forward this season?
They're all great. With the change in leadership, we have a kind of a senior council and a revolving captainship almost. So they're all great. We've got Mike Burney, Scott Drummond, Alex Wilson, Damien Hicks. We've got just a bunch of them. Brandon Beauregard, Joe Gifford, Chris Shevins. They're all just great kids. And they've really kind of taken the program and created a mission, a vision, a brand. And so that's hopefully going to take us when we get into the MAC. That's going to give us that little strength that we need to get over the top. So I'm very proud of them and what they're trying to accomplish in their last year.
Coach, if you could look into the future 3 or 4 years, what do you want this program to look like? What do you want people to be saying about Detroit lacrosse?
It's a great program. It's a great little school here in Detroit. It's got wonderful programs, nurturing programs for kids. It's a great place to show up and kind of develop into a man. We worry about the total human being, not just, you know, we're not just coaching lacrosse here. We're trying to develop them into good men, you know, the whole Jesuit tradition. So we'd like that attitude to hold true, and you know, we worry about winning, and we'd like to win a little bit more consistently than we have in the past, be good human beings and winners at the same time. So. It's a great little school. Lacrosse is very important to the campus life, so we just like to continue to, you know, grow our importance on campus and hopefully nationally and see what happens.
Coach, what we've seen in the past 2 weeks, as far as the early start to the season goes, there's been a lot of debate between people thinking that it is a little bit early. We should wait until the beginning of March for spring lacrosse to happen. Some people who are okay with it. You've got two games under your belt. They were both in arenas, so the games weren't really affected. But you being in Detroit, which can get some pretty nasty weather throughout the course of winter, does that affect your guys, your training regimen, your practice at all?
We're very lucky to have a wonderful facility very close to us that treats us like it's our home. We treat it like it's our home. It's a wonderful place to be. For the programs that are outside every day in this weather, I get it, right? It's maybe a little bit early. For us, having the indoor facility and being able to spread out the games, you know, I think with the conversation, it's going to turn into, wow, there's too many, you know, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday games or Wednesday, Saturday games. You know, you can pick your poison. Either we're starting too early or we're bunching the games too close together. So I'm not sure what the right answer is.
Coach, as you look at your upcoming schedule, and I know that you guys look at one game at a time, but where do you want to be 3 weeks from now, or as you are heading into your conference schedule, where do you guys want to sit in that position?
Sure, we've got a, we're in a learning, everyone's learning. I'm learning. I'm new at this. We've got a young staff. We've got a team that's kind of developing a whole new model of how they operate on a daily basis. So we're just going to continue to learn. We have a great event that Coach Myers actually set up where we're actually going down to Bellarmine. We're playing Bellarmine and Marquette, and Ohio State will be there playing two games. So it's a wonderful weekend of lacrosse that will continue. Next year will be up at Marquette, then it will come down to over to Detroit and then down to Columbus. So that kind of gets us ready for tournament play. We're going out to Air Force, and we're flying out there, so we want to learn how to travel by plane. It's a kind of a new thing for us, not something that we do all the time, as we can fly to some of our conference games. So everything is kind of set up to get us ready for our conference games, you know, because that's really what's important to us.
So, Coach, with the two games that you have under your belt thus far, you've been able to watch your team and see some of the things that develop throughout the course of the game, some things they do well, some of the mistakes that they made. What do you guys take into the drawing board this week to fix in order to be ready for Robert Morris this coming weekend?
We're just going to challenge everything. You know, that's something that we did very well in week one, and we didn't do so well in week two. So if we can focus on the little things and challenge each little event that happens to us, worry about that event that's right in front of us and do the best, play the best lacrosse we can at that very moment, we're going to be in pretty good shape. We obviously accomplished that in the first week, and in the second week we weren't so good, so we're going to work on being better at that in week three.
Coach Colon, we sure appreciate your time, and we'll look forward to following the Titans the rest of the year.
Okay, say nice things about Detroit. Thanks for covering lacrosse, okay?
We'll do it. Thank you.
Thanks, Coach.
Thanks, guys. Okay, bye.
That's head coach Chris Colon of the University of Detroit Mercy Titans. I know that the university is really, they still call themselves UDM, but they've really shied away from being Detroit Mercy in recent years. It's kind of an interesting new way to brand the University of Detroit.
Well, UDM was one of the probably 100 schools that I sent my tape to, so that's how I remember it.
It will always be UDM. We had a great show tonight, Maxie, in spite of the fact that we were unable to talk to Coach Keenan, who, by the way, has already confirmed for next week's show. It'll be a much easier turnaround for him as they don't have to go jump on airplanes right after their game. But we tried, and, it wasn't the greatest experiment to get Coach Keenan on tonight right after that game. And we're looking forward to having him next week. We'll be talking more NCAA, D1, MCLA, NLL. We'll hope to have Jack Coyne on and talk a little D2. D2 had big stuff go on this weekend with number one Limestone and number Tampa playing against each other, and Limestone really hammering Tampa on Tampa's home field this weekend.
Don't forget, too, fans, our first play-by-play action starts next week when Dan and I will be covering Canisius, Furman, and Air Force at Peter Barton Stadium. So tune in for that for live game coverage.
Look for all the tweets that we send out during the course of this week. And we will be right back here next Sunday after doing two live play-by-play events. Again, Canisius, Air Force at 1 p.m. on Saturday, and Canisius Furman at 1 p.m. on Saturday, and Canisius Air Force at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on Sunday. For all of our guests, Hallie Quillinen, Brian Shanahan, who am I missing?
Quint Kesnick
and Trey Lanthier, as well as head coach at the University of Detroit, Chris Colon. I'm Dan Matthews saying so long, everyone.